Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You have tuned in to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, 95.9 FM, and streaming at kgvm.org. Well, like the talking heads would say, today I find myself at the boat ramp at the Missouri Headwater State Park. Maybe I'll be able to record a raven here in a bit. It's a sunny day. It's about 53 and not much wind. And some people are coming and going. Some people are, looks like they're picking up something. I think they're doing a little cleanup out here, maybe. Anyway, this week began with a partial shutdown. And we've been through this before. And in fact, there was an emergency government shutdown when Ken Lane produced our Desert Oracle Radio episode for today. For your consideration, released by Ken Lane, February 15th, 2019, here is Down at the Old Schoolhouse.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
I have these coyotes that call me to work. It's very effective. They're always out there.
Hello and welcome to the Old Schoolhouse Museum here in 29 Palms. It's home to everything you've come to expect from an iconic desert town. You have the hardy natives, the European pioneers, the Canadian tourists, gold mines, a massive military base, open range cattle, turning grassland to sand, a bizarrely popular national park, wilderness, salt pans, crackpots, religious nuts, environmental nuts, OHVs and biodiesel Volvos, meth labs and petroglyphs. It's all here. And here we are, due to the government shutdown, the Bureau of Land Management speaker, who was scheduled to be here, as Cheryl said, had to cancel because who knows when the government and the national parks and all that will or won't be functioning. They just don't return your calls when the government shuts down. Well, that now canceled speaker was to be Kyle Sullivan, BLM manager of Mojave Trails National Monument. He's apparently working another event in Joshua Tree. So afterwards, notes can be compared. See who made the right choice. And so Kevin Wong from the Desert Institute writes me, and I rarely get an email like this. He writes me and he says, "You need to take over for the federal government." And it even says that in the press release. As a result, I took one of my kids' Junior Ranger badges. It's metal, I believe. I'm sure it's official. And if we have any emergencies or anything like that, just walk right on past me because I don't have any safety training. My occupation is editor and publisher of the Desert Oracle. This is a small periodical. It is located in the neighboring metropolis of Joshua Tree. Like most small town publishers, I am a conservative. I have been a member of the Nature Conservancy for about 35 years now. Dues paying, a vocal supporter of the California Conservation Corps, which in its modern formation was the pet project of our former governor, Jerry Brown, who described it as something between a summer camp and a Jesuit monastery. And I am a believer in conservation easements, local land trust, etc. I've had a lot of varied interests over my life and career, many of them philosophical or otherwise impractical, but the one thing that stuck, I learned when I was very young, and I learned it from Woodsy Owl in the Saturday morning cartoons. Now, Woodsy, I can't remember if he could talk. I don't think he could. But give a hoot was associated with him. And that stuck, more or less. Take care of your deserts and your forests and your mountains. Be a land conservative. And say it proud. Especially here in the eastern Mojave, the last barrier of wilderness and near wilderness, keeping Los Angeles from spilling over the desert, spilling over the Nevada state line, unholy copulation with Las Vegas, which would make things not quite so nice out here. As a middle-aged white man in 2019 America, I say like all the rest of them, I liked it better before. Especially when the top marginal tax rate was 92%. Under Dwight Eisenhower, our great Republican general and president, back when the overwhelming popularity of national parks was answered with the 2019 equivalent of a $10 billion package to invest in the parks, update the roads, visitor centers, campgrounds, restoration. That was a Department of the Interior program called Mission 66. Now maybe we'll have something like that again, maybe soon. We seem to be in the kind of depression era crisis with the climate that calls for drastic action. Maybe we'll get it. A couple of months ago, I noticed various political journalists in Washington mocking the idea of a Green New Deal. Now it's a real thing. It's making its way through Congress. Every announced presidential candidate must now have a position on this. This thing that allegedly was not serious or realistic a few weeks ago. Things can happen fast. And all the candidates, all the Democrats anyway, so far have answered this question about the Green New Deal with a pretty straightforward, yes, I support it. Well, just in time, if it happens. Maybe that's why it's happening now. We always have to push things to the point of absolute crisis because we are a species primarily known for putting things off for as long as possible. It might have developed when we were still happily living in little bands of people here and there, a time when modern economists estimate we only spent about 2 hours a day working, food, shelter, etc. The basics of survival. These are averages, of course. If a big herd of monstrous deer was coming through, you'd work every day hunting, preparing for the year ahead. You might pick blueberries all day long when they're ripe. But on average, our cousins, the hunter-gatherers, spent a couple of hours a day working, about 14 hours a week. I think we'd all do better off with a 14-hour work week, especially if that work is done outside in the fresh air, the excitement of the hunt, the easy labor of collecting mushrooms or berries from the forest. But with so much time to do important work, it is our natural inclination to put it off. Wait until the last possible minute, till we're very hungry, because then there's no choice. But now, maybe in the shadow of imminent death and destruction, maybe now we'll be forced to deal with the slow-rolling climate catastrophe. The climate change situation seems to not really have any romantic notions about whether humans are still around or not. Post-climate change, the world might be quite happy with ravens, coyotes, cockroaches, and no internet. Now, when the national parks are fully funded and anybody willing to work can put solar panels on rooftops or turn city brownfields into public parks or help lost tourists not run over Joshua trees or each other, when you can make a good living from doing good work that's going to help the general situation, we're probably going to have a happier situation, maybe, in the years ahead. For some people I know around here, they're very cynical about the future. But we can be cynical, or we can do something and be hopeful. And maybe in the years ahead, a decade off now, when President Ocasio-Cortez comes out to cut the ribbon on the new eco campground that's built on some old scrape lots in Yucca Valley, we can look back at this year and say, well, I guess that's when it really kind of started to happen, when we started to get it together. But I'm not here to talk about that. I was brought here for emergency entertainment in a time of crisis. And now it's time for strange and unusual tales from our desert. And this is something I occasionally do on Desert Oracle Radio. The idea is to inform and entertain and perhaps distract, if only for a little while, from the suffocating and pervasive gloom. And intended, of course, to encourage the habit and practice of learning all kinds of weird little stories about your place in the world. Because it really does make us feel more at home. You feel like you're where you're supposed to be, maybe forever, maybe for the next couple of months. So here are some stories about our place. If you know them, because you know a lot more about the stuff than I do, you can either complain or sit politely seething. Tell me afterwards. I was there in 1966. I have no idea what you're talking about. This is the story of the Mojave Megaphone. The Mojave Megaphone is something that exists on the far western edge of Mojave National Preserve. It's a contraption mounted upon a boulder pile. It's bolted onto two boulders in particular. And at least some desert people refer to it as the Mojave Megaphone. It's about 8 feet long. It's constructed from welded strips of iron. It's all rusted and corroded and mysterious looking. And the shape is somewhat similar to the old rocket engine mounts at Rocket Site Road, just north of Edwards Air Force Base. Now that landmark adjoins a rocket laboratory and an Air Force test flight base. The Mojave Megaphone is far from anything. It's far from anything but a now abandoned Tidewater Tonopah Railway spur, midway between Ludlow and Zizix. You take a pretty good dirt road. You can either go south from the 15 or north from the 66. I believe it's about 15 miles south of the 15. Now, I found some pictures of some guys posing with the Mojave Megaphone. So they've crawled up this pile of boulders and they're standing around it. And they don't look somber, but the captions to the photos were somber. They claim they had to make the trip to tune the Mojave Megaphone. Based on some arcane ritual, I can only suppose, and there have been claims that this is the only surviving, or only discovered as of yet, megaphone that's actually part of a chain of megaphones that goes across the desert. Like something out of Lord of the Rings, where they all lit the fires to let people know the orcs were coming. There's a theory on the internet that the megaphone was actually intended to be the horn of an emergency siren. This theory is not by anyone who was alive at the time it was constructed, but it's put down with great certainty. The idea was, if there was trouble on the railway line, and this comes from the guess that maybe chemical weapons during World War I were transferred on this spur line, if the train crashed and the chemical weapons were spilling and clouding over the desert, someone would run across the desert, climb 100 feet of boulders, attach some kind of cranked air machine to the back of this tube, and it would let people a little ways up know what was going on. A siren would work just fine 100 feet down the boulder pile by the railroad track. So it's a great mystery. I hope none of us ever finds the answer, because it is important to have mysteries in the desert. Now we will talk briefly about ghosts. It was told to me only a few weeks ago that there is some sort of annoying ghost currently active at Roy's up on Route 66. This ghost turns lights on and off, ceiling fans on and off, makes noise, slams doors, that sort of thing. Poltergeist activity. And this was told to me in strict confidence at my office just a few weeks ago by the caretaker there. So please keep this information to yourself. He doesn't want a lot of these ghost hunter TV shows showing up and ruining his nice gig out there on Route 66. In Wonder Valley last summer, according to a very reliable young man that I met after a campfire talk that I did down in Palm Springs, Strange globs of bluish light swirled all around this young man as he was sleeping on a pool chair outside in the summer heat. He woke up and all these little entities of light gave him the once-over, and then they continued over the open desert. He said he watched them tumble over the landscape. There's a persistent story of mystery tracks in Wonder Valley, and I bet some of you have heard this story. And if you have, talk to me afterwards, because it's a very weird story. I've had a number of people come up and tell me about these things over the past couple of years. The claim is residents will discover these very narrow lines that go for hundreds of yards through the sand, sometimes a mile or more. Now, the oddest part is that the lines will end, say, at the wall, the exterior wall of a homestead cabin. And then they'll pick up on the opposite side. As if whatever it is just tracked right through the house and came out the opposite wall and continued across the desert. That these lines will appear on clear mornings, and it looks just about the depth of, say, a lizard tail, with no feet on either side. The only thing I've ever heard of that is in any way similar is the famous story of the devil's footprints found in England after a heavy snowfall in 1855. Hooves that went over barns and through meadows. It may have been one of the earliest newspaper hoaxes. Another very short ghost story involves the supposed ghost of the late Gram Parsons. He was the singer and songwriter from the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers. He perished in Room 8 of the Joshua Tree Inn in September of 1973. He died of an opiate overdose, which 40 years ago was much more romantic when Purdue Pharma wasn't racking up immense opiate overdoses every year in every state in America. Well, an interesting thing is that people have to request Room 8 if they hope to stay there. You can't just pull up to the inn, so the story goes, and say, I need a room, and they put you in Room 8. The story is that nobody gets Room 8 by accident. You have to want to try to sleep in the room where Gram Parsons went in and out of consciousness for many hours and had what sounds like a pretty sad and painful death right before his one very good record came out, the one with Emmylou Harris called Grievous Angel. He had all kinds of family troubles, marriage troubles. Both of his parents committed suicide. He was, as Chris Hillman from the Byrds and Burrito Brothers once said, a poor little rich boy, born to a huge fortune from the Florida orange groves. And people just love to stay in this haunted room. A young couple from England came by my office recently. They wanted to tell me about their experience of staying in the room. They requested it. I said, was it haunted? They said, yes, by something. And maybe it was only haunted by their expectations. In any case, one of the newlyweds slept right through it. She was fine. And the other, well, he was very troubled. He said he was haunted and troubled by a corner of the room where a mirror was. In the morning, he asked at the desk, and they said, oh, that mirror is the only piece of furniture that's original to the room. Now, in most hotels, if you went to the desk and said, I could not sleep because of the terrible ghosts in your establishment, they might give you half off the night or a voucher or something. Not at the Joshua Tree Inn. People pay extra for the specific gloomy, haunted experience. Now, you all look like mostly locals and neighbors, so you know one of the main topics of conversation in the high desert. Why are there no restaurants here? Why are there so few restaurants here? There are 45,000 people in Palm Springs. There are 50,000 people in the Morongo Basin. Where are the restaurants? We have millions of tourists, just like the low desert. It is the greatest desert mystery that I've come across. Greater than the blinding white lights that converted St. Paul on the road to Damascus. But there is a type of food that originates, 20th century food that originates in the Mojave Desert. Native to the Mojave Desert, Del Taco. Del Taco, the very first one, was a hamburger and burritos shack, so call it Del Taco, of course, in Yermo, outside of Barstow. The stand is still there. Now it's a hamburger place owned by someone else. They are still headquartered in Barstow. Our local 24-hour taco shops, which tradition dictates should always be called Santana's, no matter what they change the sign to. They were founded right up the road in Yucca Valley by Don Arturo Santana back in 1986. Don Santana is the proud inventor of the California burrito. It's from here. Now, this is a burrito of truly United States proportions. It's about 2 feet long. It's got about 2 pounds of steak inside and a couple of baskets of soggy French fries. One of the leading news organizations of our time, BuzzFeed, has called this dubious invention the world's greatest burrito. BuzzFeed is based in New York. Now, back in 1855, Secretary of War Jefferson Davis convinced the U.S. Senate to fund a camel expedition from Texas to the Mojave Desert. Both one-hump and two-hump camels were imported from the Middle East, along with Arab and Turkish camel drivers. The 70 camels successfully crossed the Great American Desert and easily crossed the Colorado River, while numerous sheep and mules drowned. After reaching the Tehachapis in 1857, the camels were retired to live out their lives at various ranches in California and Arizona. Now, Jefferson Davis joined the Confederacy in war against the United States, and his enthusiasm for camels soon became unfashionable in Washington. Now, Haji Ali was the best known of the camel drivers from the old Ottoman Empire. He lived a long and happy life in the American West, and he died a half century after he arrived in 1902. He is buried in Quartzsite, Arizona, beneath a pyramid memorial topped with a copper camel. He kept some of his sturdy animals to the end as pets and friends, and he once used a couple of camels to break up an all-German picnic in Los Angeles. After the Germans refused to invite him to the picnic. Now, here's a story about a supposed fictional creature that actually was living and walking in our desert. I'm speaking, of course, of the Jawas from Star Wars. When you see the Jawas carry R2-D2 up the ridge to the enormous sandcrawler tank in 1977 Star Wars movie, you are looking at a group of costume fourth graders from Death Valley Elementary, the children of park rangers. There's more of the Mojave in Star Wars than most people realize, not least because the story of the production skips the Mojave completely, claiming that all the desert planet scenes were filmed in North Africa. This is not true. A lot of those shots from North African desert villages and landscapes had to be redone somewhere close to Los Angeles because a lot of the footage was bad. And so a very small crew was sent out in the spring of 1977, right before the movie came out, to Death Valley and other spots in the Mojave to get various scenes. In Death Valley, they got the scene of Mos Eisley Spaceport, the hive of scum and villainry. That shot is from Dante's Peak, and what you're looking at is basically Furnace Creek Ranch, but through matte paintings, they added some space buildings around it. Also in Death Valley, the sand people, who had kind of bandages and pipes all over their head, they rode these weird animals. The animal, in fact, was an elephant borrowed from a wildlife safari park in Silicon Valley. And they put these kind of bighorn costume things on the elephant and hung palm fronds off the sides of it. And it became a space alien beast of burden. Aldous Huxley, the British author of enduring fiction and nonfiction books, including Brave New World and The Doors of Perception, moved from Los Angeles to a 40-acre property in the Mojave High Desert in 1940. He produced several interesting works there, including his mythical essay, The Desert, and his grim children's fable, The Crows of Pear Blossom. Still in print as a children's picture book, some 73 years after its original publication, the children's book features a pair of crows. Now, we know they're supposed to be ravens. These crows are bedeviled by rattlesnakes. The rattlesnakes climb up the trees where the crows live, and they eat the crows' eggs. So the crows devise a very brutal and drawn-out way to murder the rattlesnakes, and then they drape the dead bodies of the rattlesnakes around the nursery of their baby crows. It's a kid's book. Now, you look like an educated crowd. You look like people who know about theology, ancient Bible texts. Joshua is the same name as Jesus. You know that, right? They're both Yeshua. So I always try to get people to call our famously weird yucca trees Jesus trees. Because it's technically the same name. And nobody ever wants to do this. But if we really wanted to get the national park crowds down to, say, Great Recession levels, maybe we could rename the place Jesus Tree. It would start sounding, you know, a little less sane to travelers. They would not be sure what's going on. There's even sort of a historical reason to do so, as the people who first brought the gospel of Jesus to California, the friars from Mexico and the soldiers who accompanied them, first saw Joshua trees when they were chasing mission Indians who had regretted their religious conversion and fled for the high desert. The first Europeans to see what is now Joshua Tree National Park were the mission soldiers chasing the native Californians, who decided they'd had quite enough of the friars and the chores. They used to work 2 hours a day, and then all of a sudden... Now, having renounced the Spanish faith, these free-again souls fled the San Diego mission for the high desert, where the pursuing Spaniards were marked upon the hideous yucca trees that we all love so much now. At least, that's one of the stories. It's lesser known than the Mormon Pioneer version, which takes place about 100 years later, about 80 years later. The Mormon Pioneers were the ones who, of course, named our bizarre and grotesque yucca trees, with their many long tentacles full of spikes and spiders, dead deer mice. I was in the Arthur Ripley Desert Woodland just east of Lancaster a while back. And there was a Joshua tree with its typical mini arms. And there was an arm just about at eye level. And there, perfectly preserved, was a deer mouse, which had tried to get up into the flowers and had fallen and was perfectly speared and mummified. And I took about 40 pictures of it. Anyway, the Mormon pioneers saw these things and said, "This reminds us of Joshua." And Joshua, the Old Testament hero who had to pray for help against the neighboring military forces and the defensive walls, and apparently when he prayed, he looked like a Joshua tree. For two decades, Minerva Hamilton Hoyt had been lobbying her friends in Washington to protect what she intended to be called Desert Plants National Monument. And when Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal was at its peak in 1936, well, that's when our national monument came into being. After 20 years of Hoyt's persuasive arguing, by the time of the New Deal, there was a huge investment in national parks and public lands. It was part of the massive federal investment in public lands that provided lots of jobs and taught a whole generation about the stewardship of public lands during the years of the Great Depression. Now, Joshua Tree, the national park, the 3 million annual visitors, the 300 music videos and fashion shoots and Netflix shows made here every week, is the way it is today, and not like the far western Mojave, Palmdale, Victorville, etc., because of the New Deal.
This is Desert Oracle, broadcasting from Joshua Tree, California, from Amboy to Zizek's, and good night from the voice of the desert.
Was not a raven. That was the rock pigeons. and I just got to watch a bald eagle take a bath in the shallows of the river and then fly away. That was pretty cool. It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, and streaming at kgvm.org. It's time for some nature readings. From Daily Observations, Thoreau on the Days of the Year, edited by Steve Grant. On February 8, 1852, Thoreau wrote, "What if there is less fire on the hearth, if there is more in the heart?" And then on February 9, 1852, he wrote, "When I break off a twig of green-barked sassafras, as I am going through the woods now, and smell it, I am startled to find it fragrant as in summer. It is an importation of all the spices of Oriental summers into our New England winter." So I wonder if there's something that you snap off a twig of and taste it now for our Rocky Mountain winter. Let me know. And from Nature, A Day at a Time, by author and naturalist Kathy Katz, the reading for February 8th begins, "Some people may crave many hours by themselves. Others may find sufficient solace in small doses of separate time. Regardless of the dosage, solitude is a deep, soothing, and persistent call in life. Alone time is vital to our peace and existence, a route open to us for survival." And that was written by Esther Shaler Buchholz in The Call of Solitude. And then the piece for today goes on. "Sociability among insects ranges from ants, which live in colonies of millions, to ant lions, which spend almost their entire life by themselves underground. Among bees, the range of social interaction varies from dense hive populations to bees living alone in burrows. Variations of aloneness span the animal world, but humans are the only species who apologize, defend, justify, hide, judge, or worse, ignore their need for solitude. Female solitary bees, such as the mining bee, Andrima, dig long underground tunnels in which they lay an egg in a single cell. They spend the winter alone, separated by cells, until the spring, when they gather nectar and begin the process of finding mates. After mating, the solitary bees return to life alone." She closes with a quote. It goes, "And yet, verbal and facial expression are still an effort for me. Only when alone or with an animal do I relax." And that was from Linda Wheelwright Schmidt in The Long Shore. And the reading for February 9th begins, "Prairie dogs, Cynomys, were named for their dog-like bark. They are members of the squirrel family and live in lonely, dry, brushy areas. In their isolated prairies, these rodents are extremely sociable with complex traditions and behaviors. They show signs of affection by grooming, touching faces, tumbling, and fondling family members and neighbors. The chemicals exchanged from kissing are a way to transfer information between prairie dogs." And then she ends this one with a quote. It says, "I wasn't kissing her, I was just whispering in her mouth." And that was from Chico Marx in Marx Brothers Scrapbook by Groucho Marx and Richard J. Annabelle. We have enjoyed a lot of readings about nature from Kathy Katz and her book, and I wanted to know more about that author, so I did a little search and found this on floridatoday.com. One of the most beautiful memorial, I would say, writings that I've ever seen about anybody. And this is from 2001, November 27th, when it was written. And I believe Billy Cox was the author. The title is Sea Bean Lady Finishes Journey. Following Kathy Katz's debut for Sierra Club Books last year, it appeared Nature, A Day at a Time, An Uncommon Look at Common Wildlife, was simply a preview of things to come. At age 52, after considerable trial and error, the much-traveled sea bean lady from Melbourne Beach had found her voice, and she regarded the enticing prospects like a kid with a nose pressed to the glass of a candy store. Quote, I'm using creative visualization, unquote, she said then. Quote, and I can picture myself as a 90-year-old woman signing books about sea beans, unquote. Like the annual Sea Bean Symposium she founded 5 years earlier, or her triannual Drifting Seed newsletter with an audience in 20 countries, or her four meticulously illustrated self-published books with environmental themes, the hooks and bends in the river of Kathy Katz's life had converged into eloquent currents of cogent observation. Her work navigated the natural world and its order, at once unforgiving and reaffirming. From the conjugation of parasitic microbes to swift endings amid raptors' talons, Katz wrote the fabric of life and death into a tapestry of eerie mirrors on the human experience, without pretension or proselytizing. She delivered an edgy point of view, cushioned with the smarts of a dispassionate veneer. So maybe, in retrospect, it was fitting that an environmentalist who mined revelations from the seemingly ordinary and insignificant found herself struggling with end-stage cancer at the doorway to broader commercial success. She had been to the brink before in her 20s when she was nearly killed in a car wreck on the German Autobahn. Quote, she told me she was living on borrowed time from that moment on, unquote, recalls Ed Perry, a state park ranger at Sebastian Inlet. Quote, she said every day she got after that was a gift from God, unquote. This from the daughter of a Jewish father and an atheist mother, her worldview shaped by Quaker tutelage through her senior year in high school. Katz's pursuit of traction drew her to jobs in the disparate worlds of Germany and Israel, to mention just two, and there were no shortcuts through the forests of familiar painkillers. What surprised her at the end of the search was the primordial simplicity that confronted her along the shoreline of her final sanctuary, the beach. The story she liked to share was her epiphany during a sea turtle encounter. For the first time in her life, Katz tuned in to an exhausted reptile as it completed its journey of uncounted miles to the scene of its birth under the shadow of night. Instead of resting, the creature merely hoisted its bulk against an impossible slope, planted its seeds in the sand, and vanished into the ocean, the source of life on Earth. Katz wasn't the same after that. Quote, when you read her nature books, you feel like you're walking side by side with your best friend, unquote, says Perry, who was recommending her work to tourists long before he met Katz 6 years ago. Quote, she was this really neat person who talked about bird poop and guts and knew how to bring the importance of ecology together in a way that the average person could relate to. Good interpretation does that. It takes you beyond the obvious and changes your way of thinking. Unquote. If Katz envisioned nature a day at a time as the first in a series of books, she also knew nature obeyed its own cycles. Still, she resisted. Perry says she eased up last Tuesday after being assured that her friends would carry on with her newsletter and the Sea Bean Convention. Consequently, her passage on Thanksgiving can only be attributed to coincidence. What Kathy Katz leaves behind is a box full of 3x5 note cards from her unfinished book. She called it Beaches and Beyond. She introduced it this way, quote, when I lost my ability to walk on the beach because of cancer, my world expanded when my friends gave me beach reports. I saw the universe through their eyes, another dimension which I've included in this book too. Could I trust that the words would come? I wasn't sure what needed to be said, but I know I had to hurry. I loved the urgency. I loved the compelling nature of the days. I was luckier than anyone deserved to have this joy of living fully for the first time, day after day, without knowing how many days were left, made each one the biggest, best, and brightest I'd ever experienced, unquote. For those who knew Kathy Katz, or for those who enjoyed her books, regular updates will be posted at low tide. And then there's a note here. Billy Cox's column runs every Wednesday. And so that again is from floridatoday.com. Well, I hope you enjoyed that little piece about Kathy Katz. And if you're a regular listener, I hope you remember it when you hear me read from her book again. Next up, you know how I like to keep tabs on people working for our environment here, people protecting the wilderness. And there are a lot of different groups around, and so here's an interview that's going to tell us about one of those groups. So I have called a person with one of our conservation groups that's local, and can you please introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Andrea Coverley, and I am the Southwest Regional Organizer for Wild Montana, and I'm excited to be on this call with you today.
Thank you. And tell me about Wild Montana. Like, how did it come to be and why?
Yeah, so Wild Montana was established back in 1958. And our main goal as an organization has always been to protect our millions of acres of public lands here in Montana, to keep it wild so that people can enjoy the beautiful landscapes that are right in our backyard.
Nice. And how long have they been doing their work?
Yeah, so like I said, established in 1958, so quite a bit of time. And obviously as times have, you know, shifted and Montana's landscape has shifted in terms of the people that are here, you know, our work has looked a ton of different ways. Originally, you know, we did a lot of stewardship and establishing wilderness. Today, our programs and staffing is, you know, much larger than it was when the organization was founded. And so a lot of our work, you know, varies. It's stewardship, trail crew projects in the summertime, wilderness walks, advocacy, speaker series, concerts, you know, you name it. We try to be out in the communities and connecting people with what we do to protect public lands and just bring people together as a community centered around that, you know, mission of public lands.
And can you tell me why it matters to the environment or the community or the habitat health?
Yeah, so, you know, Montana, being the fourth largest state, has a ton of public lands with a lot of different designations, whether that's wilderness study areas, wilderness, you know, Forest Service land, BLM land. You know, we have all these places that, you know, are in the backbone of Montana's history and our identities as Montanans. You know, we all love to enjoy, you know, these outdoor spaces in a bunch of different ways. And as far as, you know, why the work we do matters, I guess the first thing is the people matter. So making sure that, you know, all people get out on the landscape is a huge mission of ours. So hence why we host, you know, our wilderness walks or stewardship projects, because a lot of people want to get out on these places and see them, but might have barriers to entry or not know how to do that, but they care and they want to learn more. So we, you know, our work matters from a people side of things, but in terms of protecting public lands, like why that matters, I mean, why doesn't it matter? You know, it goes into, you know, we have a huge economy base that's based off of, you know, ecotourism and people who come here. Like, we have a lot of guide businesses. We have a lot of travel, as everyone knows, and sometimes complains about in the summer, you know, to come recreate here. But, you know, our home's beautiful. And so, you know, you have supporting economies of small local towns in Montana, you know, during our peak seasons. But also you think about the wildlife that exists here. You know, Montana is part of a bigger corridor. So mostly the western part of the state is part of the, you know, the Yellowstone to Yukon corridor for a lot of migratory species. And so, you know, public lands are also super important for maintaining these pathways for the species that have called Montana, as well as, you know, the rest of the Rockies and up into Canada, you know, home. You know, that's important to maintain that, to, you know, maintain our ecosystems, because when we have healthy ecosystems, you know, when we have healthy rivers, when we have healthy air, when we have a functioning ecosystem, you know, it's better for everyone. It's better for our health. It's better for the animals and their persistence. And yeah, it just, it's a full circle, and it's all intersectional. It's all very connected. And
oh yeah, I, you know, I have an interest in that myself, but I never assume that everybody that's listening knows, you know. So
yeah.
So and are there any events coming up that you'd like to tell us about, Andrea?
Yes, we have quite a bit of events up and coming. So, you know, I'm Bozeman based, but I cover Southwest Montana, and some of the big ones, little quick turnaround, but over the weekend I'll be over in Gardner, partnering with Yellowstone Forever and doing a wolf ecology lesson, followed with a little kind of scenic hike of Upper Terrace Loop in the park. That information can be found at wildmontana.org on our events page. There's still some RSVP spots available. And then in February 12th and 13th, we have back-to-back backcountry film festival showings. One is in Big Sky and one is in Bozeman. Again, this information can be found on our website, but the Bozeman one will be at the Emerson on Friday the 13th. Doors will open at 6:30. And, you know, you can do ticket purchases online, but it's just a celebration of, you know, getting into the backcountry, and, you know, it's a great thing to do in these times of minimal snow for an evening. So you can come and support us that way. You can meet me, your community organizer. I'll be tabling. We'll have a ton of amazing door prizes. We had an outpour of community sponsors for these film showings, and we have them all across the state. We've already had a couple showings like Billings, Whitefish, Missoula. But yes, we have those up and coming. And then on top of that, you know, we're in the planning process of our, you know, summer programmatics. So I would say, if there's things that you don't see on our website event-wise that you would like to see, reaching out to me, your organizer. Again, you can find my bio on Wild Montana. You know, we can organize some wilderness walks, but those are in the works for the summer and spring.
Okay. Wow, you are really informative. Thank you so much. I was going to ask how listeners can learn more or support your group too, but I think you covered that. Is there anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah. Okay. So one thing that's really special about Wild Montana, and I will say, you know, I I've been in the nonprofit sphere for only a few years post-graduation from MSU. Subtle plug for my alma mater there. But Wild Montana is a really unique nonprofit in that we're membership run or like member run, and membership is only $10 for the year. So we tried to make that barrier to entry super minimal so we could have as many people as possible join us, mm-hmm. And get to take part in the work we do as well as, you know, support the work we do. So, you know, if it's within people's capacity, I would say a great first step is to become a member. Whenever you go on the website, it'll have that, you know, bright flashy button that says join us, and a $10 donation supports the work we do, helps plan these amazing events that we have in the community, the walks, you know, all of our summer series, the advocacy. And so being a member, you know, join a local chapter, there's board meetings, and the chapters themselves host events. So that would be my only thing I would add is, yeah, become a Wild Montana member. It's a big family. There is definitely like member perks of exclusive events or things that we plan that, you know, we try to have for our members as a thank you, like annual parties, and we have an annual gathering in the fall. So yeah, it's a good time.
Oh yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. And would you like to share a meaningful personal experience that you had in a wild place?
Yeah, and I would say, you know, for the listeners out there, I was an Army kid. I, you know, didn't really grow up with, you know, proximity to wild places, so to speak. I spent most of my, you know, older, you know, childhood on the East Coast. And so I didn't really have access to, you know, public lands as easily. You know, there were state parks, but it wasn't the same. And when I moved out to Montana, you know, I was super nervous and hesitant, but always, you know, really wanted to get out into, you know, the backcountry, into, you know, doing these, you know, amazing things I'd seen all these people do that kind of drove me to Montana. And I will say, you know, after I graduated from undergrad, I took a leap of faith and actually got into the guiding world down in Yellowstone and working with kids. Mm. And, you know, now it's kind of kickstarted my master's in science education that I'm finishing up right now. And, you know, working for wild and connecting with people and getting people on the landscape, a memory that's really near and dear to my heart is, you know, I spent, right before I started guiding, I had to go scout all these, you know, routes that I was going to lead children on in the park. And it was, you know, early season. And if anyone knows early season, Yellowstone's quite muddy, quite mucky, quite
yes.
muggy, all the things, the flows are high. And my, you know, amazing partner, he joined me and we just did a summer of, you know, scouting all these routes and, you know, being waist deep and water and mud and seeing wildlife, and nobody's on the trails because the trails aren't good yet. And
yeah.
So I think, you know, just having like laughs in the backcountry and exploring new places with, you know, people that bring you joy. And, you know, I have more experiences, you know, like that I can't even count. That first summer of, you know, making this big pivot into, you know, leading people into the backcountry and, you know, trusting myself and doing my research, but also just laughing while I hiked a ton of miles and a ton of mud, you know, with a lot of trail snacks in Yellowstone, I think is definitely one of those sweet memories, because if I hadn't made that leap of faith in getting into guiding, you know, I wouldn't be where I am now. And, you know,
oh, man.
I had support from a lot of friends and my partner who encouraged me to, you know, take a huge, you know, pay cut, get into guiding and do that. And I wouldn't be working for Wild now, and I wouldn't have gotten into advocacy if I hadn't, you know, done that, you know, first little like summer job after graduation. So that's definitely one of those sweet memories.
I love it. That is just such a beautiful story. Wow. And before I end the recording, is there anything I didn't ask about that you want to be sure we cover?
The only thing I would love to just, you know, right now there's a ton of stuff going on that people can take action on. Mm-hmm. But I really would encourage people, if you haven't, you know, heard of Wild Montana, look us up online. We have a lot of petitions. There's a lot of things going on, that are threatening public lands. And I don't mean to be, you know, doom and gloom, but, you know, as folks that enjoy this state and love to recreate outdoors or just care about our wild places, mm-hmm. I would say, you know, just check out our website, join our email list, and fill out those petitions. They feel sometimes monotonous, and sometimes they feel like they don't go anywhere. You know, make those phone calls when we, you know, send out the email saying, hey, call your representative. You know, do those civic actions to protect, you know, what makes Montana so special and why we all call it home and love it so much. So that, I think, would be my only thing to add. And if anyone has questions, please reach out to me. I'm always around. I'm always available. So, yeah.
Great. Thank you. Is there a number where people could reach you?
So my number is listed on the Wild Montana website. It's actually like a work phone number. So mm-hmm. I feel bad. I don't know it off the top of my head, which sounds okay. Terrible. But when people reach out to me, you know, it gets filtered through like a Google phone just to protect, you know, my work hours. But I'm very good at responding to people. I'd say email is actually a better way to communicate with me, because even when I'm on chairlifts, I'm checking my email.
Okay. Okay.
And great. My email is my first initial, so acoverly at wildmontana.org.
Okay.
And again, that can be found on the website under the staff page.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Andrea. And I understand you're outside right now. I'm outside
yes.
right now, so I don't know if I picked up any of the sounds of the people on this trail behind the library, but that's where I am. And, yeah, just keep doing the good stuff. And thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Your time.
Well, thank you for your time, and yeah, it's a weird time to be able to sit outside in February, but
that it
know,
is.
A
yeah.
Sometimes
yes,
nice.
Yes, yes, indeed. All right,
all
thank
right.
you.
Yeah, of course.
Our background sounds today have been the headwaters of the Missouri River. Well, I want to extend my special thanks to Andrea from Wild Montana, to Red, Blue, Black, Silver, and to Ken Lane for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. And thanks to all the volunteers, supporters, and underwriters of KGVM, and to you. Do you have a story or poem you'd like to share with our listeners? I'd love to hear it. Please leave a text or voicemail for me at 406-424-6246, and I will get back to you, and we will get that done. This program broadcasts on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are archived for you on the kgvm.org website. Watch those skies, keep doing good things, and sweet dreams. Stay warm and well. I leave you with this from Mahatma Gandhi, who lived from 1869 to 1948. Quote, "In my humble opinion, non-cooperation with evil is as much a duty as is cooperation with good." Unquote. Think about it. See you next week.